had an opportunity to build a two-tower AM directional array, and Hatfield and Dawson consulting engineers did a method of moments proof that worked out quite well. At the same time, I was able to get my hands dirty and help George Wuerl build a six-tower DA in central Minnesota, and using also method of moments proof, and that's what George is here to talk to you about today. I've got a little bio here about George that I'll amend just a little bit. It says, George received his Bachelor of Electrical Engineering degree from the University of Minnesota. He already had a Bachelor's of Science from Penn State in Physics and Math, and an MBA from the University of Minnesota Carlson School. The thing it doesn't say here is that George was quite the non-traditional student when he became a student of electrical engineering at the University of Minnesota, and distinguished himself among the lab instructors there for red tagging apparently a vast majority of the test equipment in the electronics lab that either didn't work or didn't work at all or correctly. And but they still let him graduate, which I think is great. He holds SBE certification at the professional broadcast engineer level. He's been our certification chairman in Minneapolis for too many torturous years, but no one else wants to replace him in that job, so we let him continue to torture people as a proctor in tests. And when not playing with RF, which he does a lot, he teaches math in the Kumon School in Minneapolis, and he mentors young inventors at the Bakken Museum of Electricity in Minneapolis. So without further ado, here's George Wuerl.
Am I there? Am I here? All right, we got this? Good. On the syllabus, it says that I'm going to compare and contrast the classic method of doing proofs and the method of moments doing proofs. Like for a minute, I thought it was back in class doing compare and contrast papers. I'm going to go through this hopefully quite quickly. Don't expect that you're going to get enough to know how to do this because it's a lot of information here, but I want to give you the flavor of it and maybe why we're doing this in the first place. First of all, that question as to why would we want to do a proof of performance, especially in the wintertime in Minnesota or Wisconsin or Iowa or wherever. And that's basically because we need to license directional antenna systems, and that's really, I think, the only reason. To do that, we got to comply with a construction permit, and that means simply, is it in the right place? Does it produce the right pattern shape? And is that pattern shape the right size? In this day and age, that's about everything you have to do technically. I remember back when you had to go and keep it on for a couple of days to see if the frequency stayed on. But for right now, once you do that, prepare a 302, get some verifiable parameters so that you can figure out that it's going to stay where you put it, and then you're pretty much golden with the FCC. In this classic AM proof, the FCC gives you a construction permit that's listed in terms of the unattenuated inverse field. That means it's over a piece of flat copper plate. Difficult to measure your antenna system because it's over a real earth. You're going to get an attenuated field. So the first thing that you always had to do was to build some kind of a reference antenna that you reasonably understood, measure that at hundreds of points perhaps, or at least dozens of points, build the reference antenna, measure it, decide what the ground conductivity was, and once you had that, you could then start establishing the pattern shape and size for your directional. So we would start by measuring those directional fields, apply the correction factor, see if it matches the construction permit, tweak the phaser controls. If it doesn't, repeat as necessary. Lots and lots of field measurements, days, weeks, months. Anybody have one that went years? Well, sometimes that would happen. In the classic AM proof, this pattern shape that we had was really largely a function of the individual tower contributions. The pattern size is largely a pattern of how much power we put into it. The pattern shape once we determine that, we'd like to be able to reference it in the future, so we talk about an antenna monitor, a sampling system, so we can keep tabs on it on a daily basis. These parameters that we get off the sampling system, there's really no magic to them. It's just once your consultant basically had either made enough money or ran out of time or lost interest, we take a snapshot of those antenna monitor readings and say, it's in, and those are your reference parameters. But as far as an absolute measure of the performance of the antenna, they were just numbers on the day that he stopped tweaking. But we filed them with the FCC on the 302. They become our license parameters. And as long as the license parameters stay where we put them, we assume that the directional antenna system is still operating. Long-term maintenance, well, you also had these periodic parameter readings. And these days, what is periodic? How many times a day do people take their directional readings, if at all? When was the last time you took monitor points, if at all? But we still have that as a requirement to keep tabs on our system. And in the future, if you made any changes in your directional system, you would have to go back and repeat some of those process, more measurements, more tweaking, and of course, more repeat is necessary. So the question is, could this cumbersome process be improved? There are consultants that have tried it. In some cases, it was called the motel room proof. It did get you numbers that maybe might not be verifiable. But some more reputable people started working on this quite a few years ago. And this all came into being, as far as we're concerned, somewhere around February of this year, when it appeared published in the Federal Register. You'll find the details in this proposed rulemaking, 08228. The last time I checked a number of rule sites, I did not find that the sites had been updated yet. If you want the text of the FCC rules, that's where you need to go. Originally proposed in 1993, originally talked about by these reputable people in 1991, but we have it now, early this year, as an FCC, what we call method of moments. In a more general term, method of moments is just a methodology of solving complicated engineering problems. It works in acoustics, fluids, mechanics, other things. Been around for a long time. I remember 30 years ago talking to John Mullaney about a particular problem that I had, and he was talking about method of moments then, although we didn't have the computer horsepower really to do it. You may have heard it talked about as the finite element, finite boundary method. It's kind of the same thing. If you talk to my teenage kid about, I need a definition for this, he says, well, go to Wikipedia. That's where all the information is. And this is what Wikipedia says. It takes fairly complicated problems, partial differential equations, of which Maxwell's equations are part of that family, and it makes them simpler. In plain English, take a large, complicated problem, cut it up into little pieces. Each of those little pieces apply a simple function. We call it a basis function. Solve the individual pieces. Perhaps they interact with each other. We solve them simultaneously. Put it all back together and see what the result is. What are we going to use as a tool? It's this NEC. It belongs to us. It was developed with government money by Lawrence Livermore. I believe they're up to NEC 4, NEC 5. Some of it's classified. But you can get implementations of this, and you can play with it for relatively little money. What I'm talking about here is in an antenna situation. Here's a tower that may be more than a quarter wave tall, and I've got what is a relatively sinusoidal current distribution. We could solve this in the classical way with the partial differential equations, or we can say, let's simplify it and take that distribution, and we are going to segment the tower into each individual piece, and I'm going to apply a basis function for each piece that says the current is uniform and the current is constant. Any of you who have done some calculus know that when you make everything constant, calculus gets much, much simpler. Here is a NEC modeled antenna of a quarter wave. This is taken from a program called NECWIN Pro. It's produced by Nittany Scientific. This guy is fun to play with. It'll give you Yagi's and parabola. This will give you a Sturbokurten if you want to play with a Sturbokurten model. What I have done here is I've started with a segmented antenna, 10 segments. I'm not sure if you can see the colors here, but notice that the color of these segments on the bottom is red. Color of the segment on the top is blue. That indicates the relative currents in those segments. Once we do this, the NEC code will give us a whole lot of fun output. wireframe patterns of this quarter wave antenna, polar plots, Smith charts, impedance plots. You can put in multiple frequencies, give you bandwidth, all sorts of things. This particular NEC said that the drive point impedance of this tower is about 36 ohms. That's what we would expect around that to be for something a quarter wave or a little less. If I extend it to a 5/8 wave, notice we get the sky wave nubs here. Drive point impedance goes up to something we'd expect for a taller tower. All of this is right out of the computer model. Back to our task, however. In years past, we didn't have this tool to generate what the patterns were looking like, especially in the vertical plane. But we did have about 100 years of experience since Marconi. And you'll find this particular formula, for example, right in the FCC rules. This is the formula that defines what that vertical radiation pattern looks like. Off of any arbitrary vertical radiator, all you need to do is plug in this G, which is the height of the tower in electrical degrees. The theta is the degree of departure. That gives us a formula for the vertical pattern. It's a single tower. By geometry, the horizontal pattern means it's going to be a circle. And for that, we can come up with what we just did with the NEC code. Notice this is 1938. This is from the commission's rules. Here is our 5/8 wave little spur and what it looks like that we got from NEC. This one here is the quarter wave. Same thing, except this was solved in the classical way. The NDA pattern size, well, again, it's unattenuated field. We want to measure that size. That's kind of difficult. But we do know it's got to be somewhat proportional to the amount of power we put into it. Power in watts is easier to measure now, but not all that easy. However, it's really easy to measure antenna amperes. We just run that through a meter, and it's a direct measurement if we know the base impedance. That's an important point when we get the directionals. The base impedance of a single tower is determined by a bunch of different things, physically what the tower looks like, but also all the crap that we have to hang on it, including lights. Airplanes seem to like lights on towers. The FM station wants to hang the FM antenna on it, so forth. Rather than trying to model this, we have the option from the FCC to simply go out with a bridge and measure it. And that's basically because all these things, this stuff, is not expected to change as we vary the power to the antenna. The antenna should behave the same at a kilowatt as it does at 10,000 watts. And the required base current that we need for a particular pattern size can be directly calculated once we have measured that impedance. So, for our non-directional that we've just kind of built, we know where we built it from a USGS map. We got the pattern shape basically from the FCC rules and geometry. We measured the impedance. We can file the 302. We haven't turned on the transmitter yet. But you have all the information, pretty much. Back to the task if we're talking about a directional. Well, the FCC method of moments for DAs consists of a number of steps. First of all, modeling the directional array mathematically, because the computer has to understand what you built. Verifying that mathematical model against reality, because there's other stuff that you've hung on it the computer might not know about. We're going to still have to establish operating parameters. We've got to talk about sampling system, long-term maintenance and requirements. We'll get into that a little bit later. But looking at the NEC model, mathematically, we're going to do a description of the array. We want to come up with something that the NEC model can calculate an impedance on. So we're going to mathematically excite one tower in the array and float all others. And we're going to create an array of the impedances for the entire number of towers that we have. Well, in this case, the example I'm going to use is actually 7 towers. Then we're going to go back into the physical array with the bridge, physically float the towers, physically measure the towers, and also figure out all that other stuff that might be floating on it. Then we're going to massage our mathematical model so that the two of them fit. That in what we're going to have is that truth and fiction are going to be closer, or hopefully exact. Here is an example. This is out of an output from a program called MB Pro, MiniNeck Broadcaster Pro. a professional. It has some nice features in it that are particular to medium wave broadcast antennas. This is the mathematical model of the antenna that we were dealing with up near St. Cloud. Here, in electrical degrees, is the distance from the reference tower. Here in electrical degrees, the angle. This is in cylindrical coordinates. Here in electrical degrees, the height. And then we've also modeled some of the physical idea, the physical dimensions of the tower in terms of the mean radius. So these are triangular towers, but NEC likes to see cylinders, so we have to model it as a cylinder. All the towers here, you notice, are the same height. That's where our starting point was. They are all physically the same height. NEC gives us a nice little drawing. You can see that we have a six-tower parallelogram. This is a side fire. The main lobe of the night pattern is going to come towards you. And then here we have towers 1 and 7, which is a two-tower daytime, 50 kilowatts. When we do this run, and it would be the same, by the way, for all the towers at this point, we come up with a impedance of about 33.4 ohms and a little bit capacitive. Now, these were a little shorter than quarter waves. We would expect them to be low impedance. We would expect them to be maybe a little capacitive. But when we went out to Tower 1 and measured it, we came up with something really rather different. Not acceptable. It's time to massage the model. Why would we have, how could we, first of all, before we massage it, how could we account for some of these differences? This point right here is the point that NEC realizes that's the point it's calculating. This point right here is where I put my bridge. There is this stuff in there. Obviously, we got a feed line connecting the two points. There's going to be some inductance in there. We got a base impedance of a base insulator. We might have some other stuff in there. So this is some of the stuff that we have to characterize. If we have that stuff, this is a formula, and this is all going to be posted on web. You can look at it later. This is the formula that gives us the impedance at the ATU if we happen to have just a series inductance. This is the impedance and reactance at the ATU if we happen to have a reactance that is in shunt. A lot more difficult. One more thing that the FCC allows us to do is to account for the velocity of propagation in the towers. And it's kind of interesting because they will also allow you, if it works out for you, to make the velocity of propagation faster than light. I don't know if anybody's done that, but it's allowable. In our case, what we did on Tower 1 is we made the tower a little longer in the model. Now, in truth, since the currents are flowing slower than the speed of light in steel, that's a reasonable thing to do. When we do fuss a little bit with our mathematical model, I come up with a measured resistance component of 39 ohms, and I have a measured resistance component in the model. That's exactly the same. And notice that I've now gone into the inductive side. It's getting better. Resistance is acceptable at 105% of height. Here's the massaged geometry input. These are the heights that we have changed for all 7 towers in the array. And they all basically came up within about 105, 107%. Here's the rest of the output. Notice that this looks a whole lot like a 1970s DOS program, because that's when much of this was written. And although there are some computer Windows front ends for it, the engine really is still out of 1970s. Notable here is the segment lengths. This is at 9 degrees is the longest segment length. That's important for later. We've told it the frequency. If we're going to synthesize exciting one tower and floating the rest of them, we have to excite it with something mathematically, so we'll put a volt into it. And if we're going to float the other towers, this mathematical model doesn't like it disconnected. So we put a very, very high capacitive reactance there just to say it's tied to something, but it's huge. It's essentially floated. Here is what we got on that 39 ohms we had on the previous screen with our 13 ohms of J. And this also is going to give us, for our 1 volt excitation, all of the currents that we're going to see in every one of those segments. Once we've adjusted the tower matrix so that all of our towers are matching what we measured, and we can do that with adjusting the height of velocity propagation. We also can do it by taking into account the series inductance, the shunt capacitance, and so forth. We want to come up with, in this iterative process, to really massage the mathematical model and the physical reality so that they really are in close agreement. The FCC says plus or minus 2 ohms or plus or minus 4%. If we are within certain limits, we can use lumped values for inductance and capacitance. If we're outside of limits, by the way, we have to measure that. We'll talk a little bit about that in a little bit. So here's the FCC requirements. What you can use this for: no shunt-fed towers, no bazooka feeds, no weird stuff, at least not yet. You have to have at least one segment for each 10 degrees of electrical height. You can use more segments if you like, it just takes more computer time. This modeled radii, and that's the cylinder that we've modeled, in taller towers, as you increase the diameter of the tower, you will change the impedance of the tower. We can play with that, and the short tower doesn't make a whole lot of difference. Here's the modeled height that we changed, and we went from 100 to 105, 106%, so we're within our limits. You can use tapered towers, self-supporting towers, model them as a series of stacked cylinders. Makes the model a little bit more difficult to do, but you can do it. One thing you cannot fuss with is you cannot move the towers around in the model. They have to match where they actually are. And oh, by the way, this must be verified post-construction by a surveyor so that it's within the acceptable limits to make sure that what you built is what you modeled. If our lumped series inductance in the feed is less than 10 microhenries, we can assume a value. If our lumped shunt capacitance is less than 250 picofarads, we can assume a value. If it is beyond that, if you have Austin transformers, if you have lighting chokes and something like that, you have to physically get a manufacturer's idea of what it is or measure it yourself or some better realization of what that component is. Here's what we have to come up with: 2 ohms, 4%. Picture of what we actually built. This is our feed. Now, there's been some talk about it, how effective are loops in the feed of an AM tower. I believe they are effective. Other people say they're not. We stuck one in because this is in the flat country in central Minnesota, and we just got these 7 lightning rods sticking out there. We did our best job to try and come up with an idea here of what was the reactance of this loop. And measuring something that's 7 feet long is kind of difficult to do. One way is you can take and you can short this here. And if you do want to do that, you want to make sure you get some big wide strap and you get a couple of vice grips and make really good contacts. But still, you've got the inductance of the rest of this stuff. We did it to get a good feel for what these loops were. When we measured them, we found out that we got numbers in this range, certainly well within our 10 microhenries. So we were very comfortable at using a lumped value for that. Here's a tabulation of all the towers. These were the measured R's. These are the modeled R's, within a tenth of an ohm across the board. These are the measured reactances. And these are the measured feeds. When we started massaging these together, we found in some cases, notice that we're within a fraction of an ohm, 2 ohms, you know, so on and so forth. So we had what we felt was pretty good correlation, given that there are some inaccuracies in trying to measure something that's 7 feet long. And again, in terms of the reactance, we can model this as an assumed lumped value. Notice this is our model heights. Pretty much consistent. The FCC, when they develop your theoretical pattern for the construction permit, use this formula right from the rules. What it says is, in any direction and at any departure angle, what you will get here in the far field is going to be the summation of the field from a tower, we'll get the field from a tower, and this is in polar coordinates, so it's the field from the tower as modified by the spacing of the towers, the angle that the towers are at, and the electrical drive, the electrical phase delay. What we get in the far field, however, is the sum of the individual tower fields. There's that word field again. The field ratios and the phases for each of these towers are specified in the construction permit. That was filed, you know, by the consultant, you know, a long time ago. As with the non-directional, you know, measuring a field from a particular tower, especially an unattenuated field, is difficult. Measuring the something that pertains to the fields in a directional array, we could use currents, but we'd need to know the drive point impedance. And drive point impedances in directional antennas are very, very difficult because impedance can really be characterized as volts per ampere by Ohm's law. It's much the same if you put a resistor in a black box and hand it to somebody and say, what's the value of the resistor? And they measure it with a meter and say, it's this. Well, what if you stuck a battery across the resistor? They'd get a completely different reading. Well, in a directional array, that's what we're doing. When we excite all these towers, we're contributing all kinds of fields. The reason why when you adjust anything in a directional array, you adjust everything. So tower drive impedance is really the summation of that self-impedance that we were able to measure when we floated everything, and the volts per ampere contributed by everything else in the array. How do we get a handle on this? I'm going to credit Jerry Westberg, originally of Broadcast Electronics. Now he has his own company. He wrote a paper in 1989. I have a copy of it. If anybody's interested, we could probably make arrangements, you know, through the Broadcasters Clinic to get you a copy to read it. But he, through lots of mathematics and matrix algebra, was able to relate drive impedances and field ratios and therefore drive currents in directional arrays. So if you started with the fields and the self-impedances, you could calculate the currents that you needed if you also had the field ratios from the construction permit. This program, MB Pro, also has this little gem in it, which makes it so useful for what we're doing. This is the medium wave array synthesis. This is using basically that matrix algebra solution. From the construction permit, I plug this field ratio in, and it spits out the base currents and the phase ratios. I need to normalize these because one of these is a reference tower, in this case tower run, so I normalize them. These now are my operating parameters for that daytime array. Same thing for nighttime. I plug in all of the stuff I got from the construction permit. It spits back out all of my base currents and their phase ratios. I normalize the same things. In this case, I'm normalizing it to tower 2. And here's my example. For the day pattern, phases, ratios. For the night pattern, phases, ratios. Base currents that I would read. One thing to kind of take a look at is this is the predicted resistance at tower number 4, 0.8 ohm. This is the predicted resistance at tower number 6, -2.5. Sidefire parallelogram, these are the towers on the backside. This obviously is going to be maybe a problem in the tune-up. But we do have in this the full set of operating parameters. This is what we would put on the 302. This is kind of interesting. From the FCC's public filing of the construction permit, this is the daytime pattern. This is from NEC. This is calculated from the currents at the phases in those particular elements at that spacing. These were calculated in two completely different ways using the same essential root parameters, but we get the same kind of thing. And I did the tabulations on this. The tabulations work out just fine. Same thing for nighttime. What you see here is the expanded stuff. So for our directional 302 here, we have the location, which we must get from the surveyor. We've got the pattern shape, which comes from the method of moments programs. Pattern size really is something that's in our construction permit. All we need to do is to tweak up the common point to whatever impedance we desire and calculate the current that we're going to stick into it. We do have pretty much all of the information to file the 302 for the directional, and we haven't turned the directional on yet. But we still have to make it work. In our particular case in central Minnesota, we started at 8 o'clock in the morning with this information on the day pattern, and by lunch, we had the day pattern. At night, it took about 4 days. That was because we had to fuss a lot with ATUs because we had these excessively low drive points. Add into that, there were measurements to characterize the array that we had to go out, float towers, and do that. And of course, we had some time office to massage the model and such. Steve, how long did it take for yours to tune up from start to finish? Do you know? Less than a day for, and he had a two-tower DA. Quite a bit more advantageous than days, weeks, months, years of field measurements. That's not to say that you don't have to take field measurements. You do. We'll get into that a little bit later. What is proper adjustment under method of moments? Proper adjustment is that you can adjust the phasor on the antenna monitor to produce ratio within 5%, phase within 3 degrees, and you also have to certify that the impedance matrix was within plus or minus 2 ohms, plus or minus 4%. Anybody see a problem yet? What about this? How do you know it's really plus or minus 3 degrees? How do you know it's really plus or minus 5%? That's the sampling system's job. In our classic proof, we never worried a whole lot about the sampling system, really, because when we were done fussing with the phasor, we wrote down whatever we had. In this case, we are using those readings on the phasor as the basis for adjustment of the array, which means they have to be accurate in the absolute rather than simply a relative snapshot. And that puts some additional FCC constraints on what we have to do when we build the directional sampling system under method of moments. First of all, we must verify accurately the phase shift in all lines. You got to measure those lengths. And you also have to measure the surge impedance or the characteristic impedance on those lines. Not just what the manufacturer says it is, you've got to measure it. Your toroids now, if you're using toroids, they have to all be accurate. By the way, if you ever take a look at the specified tolerance on a delta toroid, what is this, 2%, 1 degree? That's in the absolute. So you have to make sure that the batch that you have are closer than that. And you have to have some idea that your antenna monitor is accurate, because this really is almost, taken as a whole, it's a laboratory instrument to certify that your pattern is in. To do these kinds of measurements, if you happen to have a network analyzer, you can kind of spec those lines pretty easily. Or you can do them with just a standard, you know, impedance bridge, general radio type. Here's a setup for a GR type bridge, I prefer using a GR bridge for this rather than a delta. RF generator of some sort, wideband detector. Now, yeah, you can take that SD31 and tune that up if you want to bust your knuckles on the switches. I just use a regular oscillator for this. The other thing about some of these receiver generators is sometimes you have to fuss with the tracking on the detector, which if you're trying to tune two things at the same time plus watch the bridge, I just use an oscilloscope. And that gave me a wideband null detector, an RF generator. Later on, I stuck when I knew what frequency I was looking for, I stuck a receiver generator over here. But once you have this set up, you simply set the bridge for short. And you look for short with the other end open. And that'll tell you what the quarter wave points are, or odd multiples of quarter wave. When we want to measure the impedance, let's look at the length first of all. You can just open circuit the line. The shorts occur at multiples of a quarter wave, and then you can ratio the frequencies to find out exactly how long it is at your frequency. To measure impedance, and this formula is, again, it's out of a textbook. This is simply measuring the resistance and the reactance at 1/8 wave either side of your operating frequency, averaging them together. And that will give you the characteristic impedance of the transmission line. Here's the measurements that we got. Length, we're within 1/10 of an electrical degree. Here's our offset frequencies. Here's what we measured in terms of characteristic impedance once we did the calculation. And then when we stuck it all together and we measured the toroids connected, the whole system, this is what we got. And again, we have to be within plus or minus 2 ohms. To measure the toroids, build up a test fixture. The FCC says you have to excite the toroids with a common current and pay attention to how you connect it to the antenna monitor and so on and so forth. I'm not going to get into sample loops. That's a whole different ball game. Placement of sample loops has to also depend on how the current is distributed on the tower in a tall tower. You have to pick what segment you're going to measure. Then, of course, you have to model the whole tower for that. So I don't want to get into that quite now. Here is a drawing of how you would do verification for toroids. In our case, we had 7, and that was about this long, really too big to start measuring. So we did them 3 at a time. Using the antenna monitor as the reference, running the transmitter into the dummy load, our toroids were 1/2 volt per ampere. The Potomac Instruments antenna monitor wants to see at least 1.5 volts on its reference input. That means I need 3 amps of current running through this. So it's a kilowatt to do the test. Here is a test jig that we built up. This is just a piece of bent, you know, silver plate tubing off of the transfer switch, and I've just changed a link out here and put it in. It's going to the dummy load. A couple of things that are important. You do not want to run these things unterminated. If you do, it'll arc in. Now, I did not do it here, but I do know it happens. It'll arc right inside this connector, and it will render the toroid useless. Second thing, because of what you're doing here, you want to make sure this is all grounded. So you notice that we have a piece of braid here that actually bolts into the bottoms of each one of those. These lines, we just cut lines, and they were small enough that we could actually measure them just across the floor of the transmitter room. And they go to the antenna monitor, and we measure the antenna monitor that way, or measure the toroids that way. We always used Tower 1 in every batch that we use in different combinations to certify to ourselves and to the FCC that these things were equal characteristics, both phase and amplitude. FCC requires sample lines within 1 electrical degree. The characteristic impedance within 2 ohms. This largely has to do with the amplitude measurement being correct. You can use toroids if it's less than 120, greater than 190. In the middle, you got to use sample loops. And again, another complete procedure for certifying sample loops. I said that field measurements were still required. Not a whole lot. 3 points per required radial. A required radial is main lobe or a major lobe and a null. So not a whole lot. Now, what do you have to do with these things? You make them, put them in the file, and hold on to them. No monitor points, no periodic stuff. These are for reference. And I was told, I think it was Ben Dawson told me, that when they were sitting around trying to formulate the report and order, somebody, I guess it was at the commission, stood up and said, well, wait a minute, shouldn't we have some readings? And they said, well, maybe we should. But it does give you an idea. We did look at the readings that we had, and yes, the nulls are where the nulls are supposed to be. And there are no monitor points, no regular readings, but you got to save these, and you do have to be able to repeat them. At least once every 24 months, you've got to go certify your sampling system. That is something new if you're going to do this, which means measure the line lengths, measure the characteristic impedance, recertify the toroids, repeat those three field measurements per radial, and then stick it back in your public file. Good. I want to do it in 40 minutes. I did. The decision that I guess is left with all of you is, do you want to try this? Do you want to do this? We've only been doing this, I guess, since February or March, April. There's a few people out there that have done it. They have been licensed. When I talked with Ben Dawson and Ron Rackley, these guys have been doing this for a lot of years. A lot of the stuff that they have done has been overseas, South America, Middle East, where they just simply show up and say, we certify it's in by method of moments, and they say, okay, fine. But in the United States, they've been using this method for a lot of years to tune the arrays up, and then they go out and measure them. So it is a tune-up tool in addition to an FCC tool. And I've kind of gotten my arms around the fact that, yeah, I think it works. You're relying a whole lot on a computer program. A computer program that is so numerically intensive that you don't want to try and calculate it by hand. You can't go in and check that thing to see if it's right. You got to depend on it. The way I interpret the rules, you pick one. If you want to do method of moments, you do method of moments. And then from there on out, if you want to make any changes, you're doing method of moments. If, however, you have an existing station, you got to do some little thing, if you want to do method of moments, you got to redo the whole thing. I don't know what kind of can of worms that may open to people. Certainly, you may have to take a good hard look at your sampling system. With that, then open it up to any questions that anybody might have. I'll do my best to answer them. This is really all kind of very new stuff, and I think we're all tap dancing on the ice to see if it really, really works 3 or 4 years from now. Yes?
I can see the advantage of using the method of moments for doing a lot, eliminating a lot of routine checks so that every 24 months you do a rather big check. But how does it relieve the guy who has the directional array on his day-to-day measurements of the array? It used to be, not too long ago, that if you had a type-approved sampling system, when you went directional, if you were non-directional daytime, when you went directional, you just had to take one set of readings.
I believe all of those rules apply.
This is still?
I believe they all still apply. This is a method of proofing the antenna system. All right? And this can be used in lieu of the classic field measurement proof.
Right.
It gets you the parameters that you file with the commission, and then basically everything else.
Okay, so as far as you know, the daily checking of the ratio and phase on all the towers, you still got to do that once when you go directional.
Well, yeah, I think the rules say as many times as necessary to ensure compliance. So, I mean, I know people that may do it once, and I know Rod Thanum, where's Rod? How many times do you do it a day? Rod does it every 3 hours on his.
Yeah, George, I had a question alluding to the motel proofs. It seems like this would be an unscrupulous consultant's easy way to motel proof it, because I have no way to go out and check a traditional monitor point and say, this thing's working or not.
Well, as a matter of fact, I was at the NAB's conference last November, and I actually kind of tongue-in-cheek said, well, so now we have legitimized the motel room proof. And some of the people kind of chuckled and said, well, it's not supposed to be that way. I think in the real-world situation, you'll submit this. The commission will do the checks that they do on it. Can it be fudged? Yeah, I guess probably. I mean, if anybody really, really wants to break the law, they're going to find a way to do it. Oh, Steve?
Some of us have spent hours or days arguing with cellular telephone companies about towers they're putting up in our neighborhood and telling us that the tower's not going to be a problem when, in fact, it met the old FCC criteria for maybe being a problem. Mm-hmm. if you do a method of moments proof and only have four or five measurement points on file, how do you deal with the next guy to put up a cell phone tower?
It is my interpretation of the rules that none of those regulations changed. If you're within a certain distance, it does trigger before and after, you know, stuff. The interesting thing is, well, what does that mean, before and after stuff? I think you may be forced to go back and recheck what you filed here, which is the tower matrix still right? Okay? One question that I have that I'm not sure has been answered to my complete satisfaction is, when we used to do classic directional proofs, you know that we would sometimes augment the proof because we couldn't make it work no matter what we did. There's no augmentation here. That's just not at all a part of method of moments. So the question is, if you have some kind of re-radiating structure that's, you know, 3 miles out and it's putting a lump when you took the measurements out there, the discussions have kind of tended to the fact that if it's that far out, it's really not influencing the pattern. It may be influencing something local, and when we build these, we're not concerned about that thing that's 4 miles away. We're concerned about something that's 100 miles away, or we're concerned about skywave departure. I have occasion to wonder about that myself, as to how close is too close and how far is too far. We're only into this now 6 months, 7 months. I think we have a lot yet to learn about it. Be interesting to see where it actually all goes. Anybody else have anything? Yes.
Are you familiar with anybody who's gone to the considerable trouble to, on a new system, run both methods and then see how closely the operating parameters they come up with match?
I think that probably some of the firms that were up there, Sufa, Cavell, and Rackley, and those guys, over the last 20 years, they probably did considerable amount of that to see if the two were matching each other. In the real-world situation, could you convince your manager to do that?
No.
And I think that it's pick one way or the other. The positives on this, there are considerable savings if you're going to build a new one, obviously, and you can make it work with method of moments. If you have an existing array, it might not be for you. The third thing, however, is if you're building something that is really strange, side mount antennas, bazooka feeds, whatever, this might be just a nightmare. You might have to go back. Yes.
Hello?
Yeah.
Here we go. I have a question. Now, when you do the modeling of your towers, and let's say your towers are lit with just standard incandescent beacons and so forth, and your boss says, well, okay, that's pretty expensive. Let's go to strobes or LEDs. So now you've changed the lighting system that's on the tower that you modeled a year ago. Mm-hmm. Does that require that you go back and remodel the whole thing?
Well, the question is, would that trigger a proof under the old rules? Would you have to go, because you're physically changing the tower. And my read of the rules is probably it would. You would have to at least go back and do some kind of a partial proof or something, because you have physically changed the configuration of the tower. You've changed the hardware. So all these other rules that trigger the classic proof, I believe that they all really apply. This is simply another method of getting you out from under doing weeks, months, years of field measurements.
Well, but that leads to another question, George. Let's say you had an FM antenna to a tower and crossed the base insulator with an isocoupler. And you said, okay, well, then you're going to have to go back and perform the traditional before and after proof. Well, it's not going to be just a partial proof because you don't have any numbers, any non-D numbers mm-hmm. to reference the proof to. So, in effect, you're going to wind up doing a full proof just to be able to do the partial proof, correct?
Method of moments?
Well, no. Let's say you've done the method of moments.
Yeah.
And he mentioned lighting, but I'll say cross the base insulator with an isocoupler for an FM antenna, which is pretty common. The rules say that if you do that and perturb the array, you need to do a partial proof before and after the isocoupler goes on the the tower. But the partial proof has to be referenced to a non-D proof.
And my answer is, you and I should take a look at the docket and check that, because the commission went through and changed all bunches of rules here and there to try and bring things into conformance, and they may have not brought everything into conformance. My read of the rules is this replaces the proof. And if you were going to use method of moments and model your tower and you happen to have a side mount, and I frankly don't know of anybody who's done method of moments with a side mount FM, but if you were going to do that, you would of necessity characterize the antenna with the FM antenna mounted on it. You'd build the matrix with that on it. You'd actually figure in the isocoupler across the shunt. You would have done all of that, and then you would have massaged that model into what the base self-impedance actually measures. So if you changed out the FM antenna, yeah, you're going to have to go back and you're going to have to remeasure the base impedance. And if it changes, my read is that, yeah, you got to repeat this. You have to reproof it. There is no such thing as a partial method of moments proof. And again, we're 6 months, 7 months into this, and I may be raising more questions than I'm answering. My intent today was to walk you through this thin ice and see where we all end up. Yes?
Someone told me you might be able to model the closer re-radiators. You would be able to model into this model. Is that true?
I have been told that. When I discussed it with some people, they said, detune them.
Right, but so basically detune it.
Well, if you were going to do the classic proof and you had a problem, you'd go and you detune it.
Right, and after the detuning, how do you prove that the array is working correctly, or do you just assume a certain ratio of detuning?
I will give you something anecdotal. When I was chief engineer of KQRS, somebody within about a mile, maybe a mile and a tenth, mile and two-tenths, decided to modify a tower. And they took one down and they built a new one in this very same place. And on this first day, they got the tower halfway up. Just so happened that halfway up on that tower was a quarter wave at 1440. My non-directional base impedance went weird. And I said, what happened? And we went out looking to see what happened, found out that it was this stub, which really, to me, to influence the base impedance at a mile away, I thought wasn't really quite possible, but it did happen. When they added the rest of the top of the tower, everything fell back into place. I believe that if you've got something that's re-radiating that's close enough that's going to cause you that kind of problem, you're going to see it that the matrix isn't going to work out right. You're going to have problems in doing that. As you noticed in the example I had here, everything fell really into very close agreement. We had seven towers. They were all physically identical. And although there were subtle differences between them, there was nothing at all to lead us that anything was, you know, re-radiating. And of course, when we look at the site, there's nothing around for miles. So in our case, we didn't have the problem. I think your point's well taken, though. But when I talked to people about what do? They said, detune it. You don't want to deal with it. Well, that's it. Thank you for your time and attention. And if anybody gets another question, I'll probably be back here for the nuts and bolts session. We can talk about it then. Otherwise, see you tonight.